Sudfeld takes the snap, steps up, throws over the middle of the field, and that is a short gain that goes nowhere. The clock has hit zero, and in one of the strangest years in NFL history, Washington changed its culture, changed its name, and went from picking second in the draft to finishing first in their division. The Washington football team has won the NFC East.
At 7-9, the Washington football team is your playoff-bound NFC East champion. And how they got there, beating the Eagles in the final game of the NFL's regular season, was as outrageous as anything we've seen this year. And with the wild card matchups now locked in for next weekend, it feels like pretty much anything can happen in the NFL. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, January 4th. This is ESPN Daily. Cool. 3, 2, 1. Bill Barnwell, it is 12:24 a.m. on January 4th, 2021, and we just watched the Washington football team defeat the Eagles, and I feel like scare quotes should be around the verb in that sentence. 20-14, and I just want to begin our conversation here by reading you this tweet from Giants receiver Darius Slayton. This is sickening.
I mean, Pablo, I understand it's been 2 weeks since I was on ESPN Daily, but I don't think we need to have that reaction.
Bill Barnwell is the host of the Bill Barnwell Show podcast, and his NFL column is on ESPN Plus.
I mean, okay, let me contextualize Darius Slayton's quote here. This is the wide receiver on a 6-10 football team, furiously mad that his team's arch rivals weren't doing enough to help Darius Slayton's New York Giants win a division title. And even worse, he might have been right, because it wasn't even about strictly the Eagles side of things. Even after Nate Sudfeld, who is about to become an all-time person in Eagles lore, even after Nate Sudfeld came into this game, Washington attempted to protect their 6-point lead by throwing an interception, muffing a punt, and fumbling an attempted handoff. And they still managed to comfortably win this game without ever getting into danger. They were the winners. So imagine how bad the other three teams in the NFC East must have been this year.
Various esteemed colleagues of ours are mad, very, very mad, talking about disgrace and integrity and respect and pride. And this is the boogeyman word here, tanking. They're talking about tanking, Bill, because Nate Sudfeld, human meme, in fact, has embodied that concept tonight. So tell me how mad all these people should actually be.
Let me preface this by pointing out a fact that I think people are not paying attention to. Jalen Hurts was playing awful. He was not good in this game. And I like Jalen Hurts. I think he has done a lot of good things since taking over for the Eagles. He was 7 of 20 for 72 yards with an interception in this game. On the final play he had, the Eagles went for it on fourth down near the goal line, and Hurts missed a wide open receiver for what probably would have been the game-winning touchdown. Jalen Hurts was struggling. When it comes to how mad people should be, I think it depends on the person. And I think it depends on the organization involved. And let's start with the Giants. You mentioned Darius Slayton. Let's start with the Giants. I think they should be a little mad, but I think they should be mad at the league, not mad at the Philadelphia Eagles, because we know the Eagles are not incentivized to do well or play their best possible roster in a meaningless game for them in terms of their record for the sake of the Giants. The Eagles moved up to the sixth spot in the draft by losing. They would have had the ninth slot in the draft by winning this game. And for them, in the first round, that might be the difference between the Eagles being in position to draft a quarterback in this year's draft if they want to, as opposed to being stuck with Jalen Hurts and Carson Wentz. If the Giants are really mad that the Eagles didn't do enough to help them win the division, they should win more than six games the next time they want to win the NFC East.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
Now, if the players feel slighted by what happened, I think that's a problem. And this was a bad day for Doug Peterson to begin with. Of course, the day started with Chris Mortensen reporting that the relationship between Peterson and Carson Wentz was fractured beyond repair. and that Wentz intends to ask for a trade this offseason. At the same time, you might say it's been a bad season for the Eagles in general. And Pablo, I might invoke Hanlon's razor here.
I'm not familiar.
Okay, well, Hanlon's razor, Pablo, is that you should not attribute to malice what you can otherwise chalk up to incompetence. I think the Eagles have been incompetent for most of the season, and they were just incompetent in kind of a clumsy way on Sunday night.
It takes a lot to unseat Occam's razor as the number one razor in my power poll of razors, but I think Hanlon actually deserves that. That is a cutting insight into human nature. Yes. Oh, wow. Please pretend that I did that on purpose. Bill, if only the NFC East had the integrity and the justice of the NFC North.
If only.
If only. Because we also saw on Sunday the top-seeded Packers just obliterate the Bears 35-16. But the relentlessly mediocre Chicago Bears at 8-8 still get into the playoffs. And that's because the Cardinals lost to the Rams, which we'll touch on in a bit. But what did you see from Bears quarterback Mitch Trubisky here? And what do you think this playoff berth, capital P, capital B, does for his future in Chicago?
I would say not much. I think that Mitch Trubisky has played better over the last month of the season. But the idea that he suddenly figured things out and he's a franchise quarterback was pretty quickly revealed here by a better Packers defense than the defenses he's been playing during this impressive run by the numbers. The Bears were able to sustain some drives early by converting fourth downs, but as the game wore along and the Packers got ahead, Trubisky wasn't able to raise his game and really compete with Aaron Rodgers. Allen Robinson was not a factor in this game. And if he's not bossing opposing defensive backs around, Trubisky isn't going to win games for the Bears on his own. He doesn't have the accuracy downfield, doesn't have the ability to make plays like that on a drive-after-drive basis. So I think Trubisky's future might still be up in the air, even after this impressive stretch. And it might depend on what we see from him over the weekend against the Saints in the wild card round. We know this brain trust, Ryan Pace, Matt Nagy, they spent most of the last few years assuming Trubisky was going to be their franchise quarterback before the 2020 season. So I think they would love nothing more than to be proven right. It makes them all look smart. Everyone probably gets a contract extension if Mitch Trubisky turns out to be a great football player. I don't think that's going to happen, but the Bears might not have much of a choice for 2021. They're not in great cap shape, so they might find themselves in a situation where they go cheap at quarterback and don't spend all that much by re-signing Trubisky for another prove-it season. So I think the Saints game will give Trubisky his chance on a national stage to prove that he's something different than the guy the Bears were planning on moving on from after the 2020 campaign.
That Cardinals-Rams game, Bill, I want to get to that with you because the Rams won this game with John Wolford at quarterback, and this Cardinals team that once looked super promising with Kyler as a dark horse MVP at one point and Cliff Kingsbury as like the next offensive guru on the rise, that team just face planted again, and they don't seem to be able to stop face planting at this point in the season. So where does Arizona go from there?
I think Kyler's going to get some rest. The first thing he's going to do is just sit up for a couple weeks on the couch. He's been banged up during the second half of the season. He was dealing with shoulder and leg injuries, came into the game on Sunday less than 100%. Suffered an ankle injury in the first quarter.
Kyler Murray had Morgan Fox land on his right ankle. Now, we'll see just how serious it is. Murray did hop up and go to the sideline under his own power.
And then sat out for most of the game. He only came back in the fourth quarter after backup Chris Derfler had struggled to move the football. Murray battled gamely, hit a couple of big throws in a row right after returning, but couldn't make magic happen off script the way he has so many times this season. Cliff Kingsbury, strangely, didn't even seem to notice. I mean, he had Kyler Murray running a speed option on 3rd and 18 on the next drive. It was very bizarre. The Cardinals had a field goal blocked, didn't get in scoring position on their final two drives of the game with Murray, and then brought back in Streveler once it was garbage time and their season was over. Now, I don't think the Cardinals are going to do anything drastic. I don't think they're going to fire Kingsbury after losing six of their final nine games of the season. But by the time we got to week 17, even before Murray went out injured, this offense was basically dependent on Murray and DeAndre Hopkins making magic happen. And we saw what happens when you don't have those guys. The Cardinals never had a plan B after Marion Hopkins this season, and they really need to find something else, whether it's a deep threat, a reliable second receiver, a tight end, maybe even a steady running game. They have to get something else on their offense that works besides Kyler Murray to DeAndre Hopkins in 2021.
I want to turn now, Bill, to the team the Rams are going to play next in the Seahawks. And on Sunday, Seattle scores three touchdowns in the fourth quarter to beat the Niners by three. And the Rams and the Seahawks split their series against each other this season. Seattle won the more recent game in late December. I know that. I also know that all Seahawks fans fundamentally have deep-seated trust issues. So how should these fans be feeling about their team right now?
Conflicted. I think the way that Seahawks fans typically feel about their team. And I think we know that they've been playing better in the second half, but the numbers are actually pretty stark. Since week 10, over the second half of the year, the Seahawks are allowing the fewest points per drive of anybody in football. Honestly, Pablo, this was a 2019 Seahawks game. The defense held on for most of the game. The offense struggled. Then in the fourth quarter, Russell Wilson threw some passes, figured it out, and the Seahawks won a close game. Getting into the postseason, though, I think this is the most difficult team to judge in all of football because we know what their ceiling is. They can have a dominant passing attack and a dominant defense. They've had both those things at different times this year, but they've never really had it together in one single game. But it's tough to see them doing it four straight times in the postseason after not really doing it once during the regular season. Jamal Adams and company really gave Jared Goff fits the last time these two teams played. So I think they're excited about facing the Rams this weekend, but I do think that it's tough to see them making a significant playoff run if they can't get everything working at the same time.
So it's important to note here, Bill, that you are currently cooking up your big regular season awards column. And reading between the lines there, it sounds like Russell Wilson probably not going to be your MVP in the NFC at the very least. So who is getting that Bill Barnwell NFC MVP award this season?
Going straight onto their mantle, I think it's fair to say, forget the Associated Press award. This random piece of paper they're going to print out from ESPN.go.com. Not Russell Wilson, though. He was my pick after the first half of the year.
That's right.
I would say Aaron Rodgers is my pick. And I don't think that's particularly shocking in terms of selections, but Aaron Rodgers was typically great in Sunday's victory over the Bears. He leads the league in every major quantitative category you can find. And on Sunday, 19 of 24, 240 yards, four touchdowns.
Throws the middle. Touchdown! Devontae Adams from Aaron Rodgers' six-yard touchdown laser.
Matt LaFleur is my favorite for Coach of the Year, and I think Aaron Rodgers is my pick for league MVP.
All right, Bill, up next, I need you to help me scan the AFC's playoff picture. And I want to start with the suddenly playoff-bound Cleveland Browns.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Bill, in the AFC, I feel morally obligated, honestly, to start with the Cleveland Browns, who finally broke the longest active playoff drought in the NFL dating back to 2002.
The Browns will get their 11th win of the year. They'll go to 11-5, and they're going to the playoffs.
They narrowly beat the Steelers, who were, let's be very blunt about this, resting all of the good players, basically, 24-22. And I do want to let Cleveland enjoy this moment, but Bill, how close did the Browns come to just Brownsing themselves and breaking their own hearts at the very end there?
Oh, Pablo, this was stressful. I'm not even rooting for the Browns. I have no vested interest in the Browns making or missing the playoffs. And yet, by the end of this game, I was screaming at the television and watching through my fingers. There were just so many moments in this game, especially in the fourth quarter, where it just felt like the Browns were being pulled out of the postseason by some historical hidden hand. Things kept going wrong. I mean, they might have been able to celebrate earlier in the fourth quarter. They had a 4th and 10. The Steelers were about to give the ball up, and instead Chase Claypool catches a 50-50 ball for a touchdown. The Browns get the ball back. They drive into field goal range to make it a 2-score game. That would have been the point where Browns fans could have started celebrating, but Baker Mayfield got sacked. The Browns ended up in 4th and 6, went for it, and failed. All you have to do then is just stop the Steelers and Mason Rudolph from scoring a touchdown. They couldn't do that. Mason Rudolph hit a bomb to Deontay Johnson and then a touchdown pass to Juju Smith-Schuster. At this point, Pablo, I was sure the Browns were losing. I was so sad. Again, for a team I have no rooting interest in whatsoever. And then, because it's 2021 and this is a new world,
yes,
and happy things can happen to people who have been suffering for a long time, the Browns stopped the two-pointer.
Rudolph to throw. End zone. No good. He missed it.
They picked up the ensuing onside kick, even though Steven Carlson, the backup tight end who the ball was kicked at, recovered it with his butt, which was a thing that happened multiple times on Sunday. Baker Mayfield got the ball, needed to get a first down, picked up a 3rd and 3 with his legs.
Mayfield takes the snap. He's going to run it to the right. Mayfield turns the corner and got the first down on the right side. He slides inside the 40-yard line.
And that was enough to bring nearly 20 years of playoff misery and a miserable, stressful Sunday afternoon for me to an end.
And now, Bill, Cleveland gets the opportunity to run it back because they play Pittsburgh again this coming weekend in the wild card round. So how do you see the rematch here going?
I think it's a big ask for the Browns to pull off back-to-back victories. I mean, earlier this year in week 5, the Steelers blew out the Browns, one of their few blowouts this year, beating them 38-7. The Browns, we just talked about it, nearly lost to a Steelers team without Ben Roethlisberger, TJ Watt, Cameron Hayward, and a bunch of other stars. Anything's possible in the postseason, but it sort of feels like the Steelers would have to have a game where they beat themselves with mistakes and turnovers for the Browns to win.
So filling out the rest of the playoff picture here, Bill, we know the top 2 seeds are locked in because the Chiefs get that all important first round bye. That's all well and good. The Bills grabbed the number 2 seed Sunday by blowing out the Dolphins by 30. And the Dolphins are the team I actually want to focus on here because in a game that was must win for them, they got curb stomped basically. And now they're missing the playoffs entirely. Mm-hmm. So how did such a promising season fall apart and why?
I feel like we are always very quick to credit and blame the quarterback for a team's problems or successes. But it's also not hard to point to Tua Tagovailoa as what went wrong with this football team. You look at their losses over the second half of the season with Tagovailoa as their starter. He had a brutal performance against the Broncos in a 20-13 loss against the Chiefs in a game where the Dolphins forced 4 takeaways from a team that was not turning the ball over all season. Tagovailoa was not able to produce big plays in the passing game. He was benched for Ryan Fitzpatrick in that miraculous comeback victory against the Raiders. But with Fitzpatrick on the COVID list on Sunday, the Dolphins had no choice but to ride with Tua. And Tagovailoa was just not playing very well. He was pretty much a disaster for most of this football game. He showed no desire or aptitude to push the ball downfield until it was too late. And when he did try and make those throws, it typically weren't very accurate.
So how should the Dolphins be feeling about Tua, Bill, with the NFL draft now looming ominously, perhaps, in the distance?
I don't know. I don't think it's fair to lose total faith in Tua Tagovailoa when before the year you thought he was your franchise quarterback of the future. He's only made 9 starts, and 9 games are not enough to tell us everything we need to know about a young quarterback. Now, at the same time, the Dolphins have a rare opportunity. They have the 3rd pick in the draft, after the Texans, who they traded Laremy Tunsil to last season, finished 4-12. Most teams don't have the opportunity to draft a young quarterback in the top five in back-to-back seasons. The Dolphins do. They have a couple different ways they can go. They do need to add a significant weapon on offense at receiver. And where they're positioned, they could draft LSU star Jamar Chase or Alabama wideout Devontae Smith, who was the best player on the field when Alabama blew out Notre Dame this weekend. But it really all depends on how they feel about Tagovailoa and about the quarterbacks who are going to be on the board after presumably the Jaguars take Trevor Lawrence with the first overall pick.
So speaking of the Jaguars, Bill, the Jaguars barely lost to Indianapolis on Sunday, which officially sent the Colts into the postseason where they're going to play the Bills in the wild card next weekend. I want to understand what Indianapolis has been doing better. I want to understand the recipe for success. So what do you expect to see them do in the postseason?
Okay. So let's start with the formula first, because I feel like as football fans, we love the idea of a team slow playing something. We love the idea that a team is not revealing their strategy until the last possible second. We love the idea of a team saving their money plays or resting their stars until they need them, at which point they're going to absolutely explode and look like a totally different football team. Now, I think most of the time, it's nonsense. Teams just are desperate to win every single week. They don't have that sort of patience to leave things in reserve. An exception might actually be what the Colts are doing with Jonathan Taylor, their star running back. So Indy was pretty aggressive rotating Jonathan Taylor, Nyheim Hines, and Jordan Wilkins through the first 9 weeks of the season. Jonathan Taylor was only averaging 12.6 carries per game after being drafted in the second round. But since the midseason win over the Packers the following week, Taylor's become the focal point of this Indy rushing attack. He's averaging nearly 20 carries per game, including 30, a career high, for 253 yards in Sunday's win over the Jags.
Rivers, ball in the near hash, hands off to Jonathan Taylor. Huge hole! He's at the 30! He's going to go! 10-5! Touchdown! Jonathan Taylor!
And you have to figure, given that they're very comfortable using Taylor as their focal back now, they're going to keep doing that into the postseason. And the Colts are sort of hard to judge because they feel like a football team from 1985 in a lot of ways. They're going to run the ball. They're going to try and avoid mistakes. And they're going to play very sound defense without necessarily some of the stars we see in other football teams, outside of maybe a Darius Leonard or a DeForest Buckner. So I think they need Taylor to get hot to go on a playoff run, but it wouldn't shock me if the formula worked for a playoff win or two.
There is no running back right now, Bill, that is hotter than Derrick Henry. The guy hit the 2,000 rushing yard mark on Sunday.
Henry charging forward for 5 yards and a first down at 2,000. History for the king.
As the Titans doinked their way ultimately to the AFC South crown and this win that was very close, surprisingly close, against the Texans. And they'll get the Ravens this weekend. But in terms of what this Titans offense has accomplished, do you see Henry or Ryan Tannehill, their quarterback, as a viable MVP?
I don't think either of them are going to win regular season MVP. I think Derrick Henry could have a shot at Offensive Player of the Year. And I do think that we could see either one of these guys step up and maybe be the MVP of the postseason, because they're both playing at a really high level right now. We saw Henry have an incredible playoff last year. He really carried them almost all the way to the Super Bowl. But Tannehill was really along for the ride. He didn't have to do very much and didn't have to throw very often until the AFC Championship game in the second half against the Chiefs. This year, Tannehill's more integrated into the offense. He's throwing a little bit more, and he's running the ball very effectively. On Sunday, they each produced 250 yards and two rushing touchdowns. Henry ran for his 250. Tannehill, of course, threw for 216, added 38 more on the ground, and those two rushing scores. And we saw when Tennessee needed a big play, Ryan Tannehill somehow found A.J. Brown for a miraculous completion to set up that doink.
Snap, set, Sloman's kick is up. His kick hits the upright and goes through.
Yes!
It
yes!
Good!
Yes! Yes! Yes!
And the vision-winning field goal. This offense can be absolutely unstoppable when it gets going. And for a Titans team that we know last year had a couple upsets for winning against the Chiefs in the AFC Championship game, we know they can get hot against the best teams in football.
So I am now crossing off Derrick Henry and Ryan Tannehill off of my viable Bill Barnwell MVP cheat sheet. So tell me, who are you picking as the MVP of this conference?
As the MVP of the AFC, Pablo, it is a very tough call between two people. I think Josh Allen has made a very strong case to get in the MVP discussion over the past few weeks.
Yes.
And I think the Indianapolis Colts probably need to buy him a fruit basket or like a cookie cake or something like that after what Josh Allen did to the Dolphins in the first half on Sunday. But I still have to go with Patrick Mahomes. It's not by much. I mean, the Chiefs star tops Allen in most of the major quarterback stats: QBR, touchdown to interception ratio, yards per attempt, and passer rating. They're not big margins, but by a tiny margin across the board, Mahomes has been a little bit better. And Allen has been great as a runner. And I think it's fair to say, over the past few weeks, heading into the postseason, Josh Allen has been the better quarterback in December, which I'm not sure I would have expected to say that about Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes before the season. So full credit to Josh Allen. He's playing awesome. If you wanted to give him the award for AFC MVP, I would have very few arguments. I just think Patrick Mahomes has been a tiny bit better over the course of the regular season.
So before we turn our attention to the postseason, Bill, before we wave goodbye to everything that happened in the regular season, who had the most riding on week 17 and all of the chaos that we witnessed?
I'm very excited about this because happy when players get money and are able to celebrate it on the field. One of the great hidden stories every week 17 involves players who have incentive clauses in their contracts. If you watch the Saints game on Sunday, you saw Emmanuel Sanders literally do like a touchdown celebration in the middle of the field, and his teammates were surrounding him doing the Johnny Manziel money sign after Sanders caught his eighth pass of the game, which triggered a $500,000 incentive. Likewise, the Seahawks, they could have kneeled to win the game against the Niners on Sunday, and it was actually a pretty close game by the end. They did not kneel and instead threw a five-yard pass to David Moore to trigger an incentive. That was with 22 seconds left in the game, where something could have gone disastrously wrong. But the most lucrative and the most bizarre and bizarrely frustrating incentive of the day belonged to Vikings tackle Riley Reiff, who wasn't even playing. He was sitting at home after being placed on the COVID-19 list earlier this week. As Chris Thomas has noted on Twitter, Riley Reiff had an incentive in his contract which would have paid the lineman $1 million if he suited up for 93.75% of the Vikings snaps this season. Heading into week 17, Riley Reiff was above that number, but the result was clear. If the Vikings ran 67 plays or more on offense, Riley Reiff was going to fall below that threshold and miss out on that $1 million bonus. I know it's 2021. I know we want to celebrate a new year and a more hopeful season, but there was still a little bit of 2020 left in the 2020 NFL season. Pablo, the Vikings ran 74 snaps on Sunday.
No!
They won 37-35. But in the process, Riley Reiff missed out on $1 million. It's a tough sport.
Bill Barnwell, to be clear, thank you for hitting all of your incentives all regular season on ESPN Daily.
Excited for my $1 million prize for hopping on the show with you every week. Thank you, Pablo.
You might get a cookie cake. All right, coming up, a tribute to the man behind the most iconic team anthem in all of sports.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. In the magical year of 1963, Jerry Marsden and his band made music history. Jerry and the Pacemakers became the very first act to hit number one on the British charts three times, with each of their first three singles. Their debut hit was called How Do You Do It?
How do you do what you do to me?
And then came a song titled I Like It.
I like it, I like it.
But Marsden's third single was the biggest hit, and it was a cover, actually, of a show tune from the 1945 Rodgers and Hammerstein musical Carousel. Its name was You'll Never Walk Alone. You may now know this song as the iconic, world-famous anthem of the soccer team Liverpool, whose players and officials and supporters all mourned the passing of Jerry Marsden yesterday at age 78 from an infection in his heart. Marsden was a super fan of the club and known as a true son of Liverpool. In fact, Jerry and the Pacemakers were signed by the same manager and producer as the Beatles, a local rival quartet that came to know the power of having a stadium completely in your thrall. But not quite like Jerry. Not like they do it at Anfield, where You'll Never Walk Alone was adopted in 1963, becoming as much a part of this team as any song ever has in any sport, anywhere. The four words in the name of Jerry Marsden's third single are now inscribed across his favorite team's crest and forged in gold letters atop Liverpool's front gates. And they are sung alongside his voice at every single game, in celebration, in solidarity. And now, in tribute. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll walk with you tomorrow.